It's Wednesday, November 19th, 2008, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Welcome to Hump Day, dear Stashers. We've made it to the middle of the week. We've got more hemp headlines coming out on new members of the Obama administration. And once again, some stories from the past about those members that leaves us scratching our head about the future of drug law reform in this change administration. We'll check on that in just a minute. Also, it's our Cannabis Science Day, so we're going to be visiting with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. And today, Dr. Mitch and I talk about these recent studies that have shown that this idea of cannabis-induced psychosis may just be schizophrenic people who have their first psychotic episode when they smoke marijuana. We'll talk more about that in our Cannabis Science segment. And our other interview, my first interview with a Canadian government official, Philippe Lucas from the Vancouver Island Compassion Society joins us, and he just ran for and won a spot on the Victoria, British Columbia City Council. So we'll talk with Philippe later on in the show. And we've got a special musical break for you featuring some remixed music from the legend himself, Bob Marley. All right, folks, it's going to be a nice, easy Wednesday. Let's not do anything fancy this time. Just roll yourself a J and enjoy your normal daily audio stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Obama's Attorney General nominee supported 5-year minimum sentences for marijuana possession. Oh, the news just keeps getting better and better regarding President-elect Obama's nomination of Eric Holder as Attorney General. Yesterday, I told you of Holder's support of Rudy Giuliani's broken windows theory of policing back in 1996 in Washington, D.C., and that Holder believed prosecuting minor marijuana possession was a key in preventing greater crime. Well, now, thanks to some sleuthing by Steve Bloom at Celeb Stoner, we get this revelation that Holder, in 1997, supported 5-year mandatory minimum sentences for anyone caught possessing marijuana with intent to distribute. To Eric Holder, the first black to lead the country's largest U.S. attorney's office, marijuana is not just a gateway drug, it is an avenue that leads to violent crime and death. Holder is convinced that selling marijuana in drug-plagued D.C. should be a felony, not simply a misdemeanor, as current law dictates. Said Holder, quote, I have taken a lot of grief for my attempt to make selling marijuana a felony in the district, not just a misdemeanor. I introduced the legislation in December that would make distribution and possession with intent to distribute marijuana a 5-year felony. I've been criticized for it by reporters in various publications, saying things like I have reefer madness. Given the harm that drugs have done, I believe that mandatory minimum sentences are appropriate and make the Superior Court's drug court more effective. For years, law enforcement had the notion that nothing could be done to knock the crime rate down, and I reject that. I reject that. An efficient, well-run police department can be effective in reducing crime rate, and I think an efficient, well-run, properly funded federal drug strategy can have an effect as well on the selling and use of drugs. End quote. Folks, this is getting scary. Quotes like that I would expect from the drug czars of the past 30 years, but from the Attorney General nominee of Mr. Change I Can Believe In? The Senate Judiciary Committee will be running the confirmation hearings for Mr. Holder. I've got a link up at our blog at stash.normal.org that you can use to contact the members of this committee, and we'll remind you again come this January, and ask the senators to ask Holder a few questions about his drug war stances from the 1990s. We've got a couple of example questions up on our blog at stash.normal.org. Marijuana-like compound helps old rats remember. From Bloomberg.com. A daily puff of a compound like marijuana, the plant blamed for ruining potheads' recall, might help maintain memory in old age, researchers who tried it on rats reported today at a neuroscience meeting. Elderly rats remembered their way around a swimming pool and could find hidden resting spots after Yannick Marchalant and his colleagues at Ohio State University gave them a compound that mimics the effect of marijuana on the brain's cannabis receptors. The marijuana-like drug, known as WIN-55212-2, spurned new brain cell growth and reduced inflammation, the researcher said. Inflammation in the brain may be linked to the development or progression of Alzheimer's, a progressive disease that destroys brain cells, disrupting the memory and cognitive capacity of some 4.5 million Americans, some scientists believe. Marchalant and his colleagues have been hunting for drugs to reduce inflammation. Marchalant said in a telephone interview yesterday, quote, We used a low dose because we didn't want to give them a drug that tried to save their memory while we're also causing psychoactive effects. The dosage of WIN would be like giving one puff a day and not a whole joint. End quote. Once again, a news report that opens with the slur potheads. The term cannabis users or marijuana users would have worked just fine in that sentence. It wasn't a headline where you're trying to save space. It's bad enough that Bloomberg promotes the notion that potheads can't recall things when research from as recent as 2006 shows that, quote, no evidence was found for long-term deficits in working memory and selective attention in frequent cannabis users after 1 week of abstinence, compared to non-using healthy controls. Furthermore, cannabis users did not differ from controls in terms of overall patterns of brain activity in the regions involved in these cognitive functions, end quote. But to compound the medical scientific error with a social faux pas of using derogatory epithets in what purports to be a news story is even worse. Attention, news media. When referring to the plant, we prefer cannabis. Marijuana is a Mexican slang term born of early 20th century racism and should only be used in the context of medical marijuana, as that is the term that is used in statute. Dope. Grass, weed, and pot are questionable, especially dope with its connotation with heroin. If your context is humorous or trying to capture street terminology, those might be used, but never in the context of the medical use of cannabis, like medipot or medical weed or pot doctors. When referring to us, pothead and stoner are to be as avoided as you would avoid queer or Negro. We are cannabis consumers or cannabis users. If you need to refer to someone who truly has a problem with cannabis use, cannabis abuser is preferred to cannabis addict. But I digress. Neat story about the rat brains. This helps support some of the other research into the role cannabinoid medicines can play in fighting degenerative brain disorders like Alzheimer's disease. Obama names Tom Daschle for Health and Human Services. President-elect Obama continues to name members of his new cabinet. Former Democratic Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle from South Dakota has been named to head up Health and Human Services. Now, as a senator in 2003, Daschle was sponsor of Senate Bill 22, a sneaky way to get the unpopular RAVE Act through Congress after now Vice President-elect Biden was unsuccessful in passing it the year before. This is from the National Review Online in 2003. Last year, there was a big push in Congress to enact the so-called RAVE Act, sponsored by Representative Lamar Smith, Democrat of Texas, as H.R. 5519, and in the Senate by Joe Biden, Democrat of Delaware. Both lead sponsors were very forthright. The very title of the bill announced its intention to go after raves, dance parties popular with Generations X and Y. But the RAVE Act aroused enormous opposition, so much so that the Senate Judiciary Chairman withdrew his co-sponsorship of the bill. This year, the same act is backed, but this time it's concealed deep within an immense omnibus bill sponsored by Tom Daschle, the so-called Justice Enhancement and Domestic Security Act of 2003. And the RAVE Act appears too, only this time the word RAVE never appears in the title. Rather, the RAVE Act language is found in sections 5131 through 36 under the misleading title Crack House Statute Amendments. The Daschle bill extends the federal crack house law, which makes it illegal to maintain a building for purposes of drug consumption, to cover musical performances and other events of a temporary nature, and to make liable even those who make their premises available at no charge. The idea is to make the promoters of musical events liable for drug consumption at those events, even when the consumption is entirely incidental and has nothing to do with any action by the promoters. The legislation is, in effect, an admission of failure by the Drug Enforcement Agency. Unable to control drug use, it's looking to force concert promoters and theaters to do it on pain of imprisonment. As amended by Daschle, this language is broad enough to encompass not only rave promoters and disc jockeys, but also bar owners, hotel or motel owners, concert promoters, tour bus or cruise ship operators, and even homeowners. Literally read, the statute would even apply to a homeowner whose teenagers occasionally smoked marijuana on the property. Fortunately, Daschle's stealth RAVE Act died in committee. Unfortunately, President-elect Obama's initial choices for the law enforcement, government, and health posts that will most impact cannabis in this country include Vice President Joe Mandatory Minimums Biden, Chief of Staff Rahm Silence Doctors on Medical Marijuana Emanuel, Attorney General Eric 5-Year Mandatory Minimum for Pot Holder, Drug Czar Jim Raid the Medical Marijuana States Ramstead, and now Secretary of Health and Human Services Tom Stealth Rave Act Daschle. If only they could get Sergeant Stadenko to head up the DEA.
In 1937, Samuel Caldwell was the first person arrested for marijuana in the United States. In 2008, the 20 millionth person was arrested for marijuana in the United States. After 71 years of this failed prohibitionist policy, it's time to say enough and demand a change. Normal is calling on you to help spread the word, and in doing so, you could win $2,500 in our 2008 Pro Cannabis Law Reform Ad Contest. Just create a 30 or 60 second video or flash animation explaining why we need to end adult marijuana prohibition. Theme ideas, examples from past contests, and the contest rules are all available at normal.org.
Just look for the Pro Cannabis Ad Contest banner. You could win your share of $10,000 in prizes, and the grand prize $2,500 winner will be featured in upcoming Normal web and television campaigns. Join our Pro Cannabis Ad Contest today. Deadline for entries is January 15th, 2009. Who is telling you the truth about marijuana? The government? Scientists? Doctors? Which claims are scientifically valid, and which claims are reefer madness? Every Wednesday, we separate the stems of propaganda from the buds of truth with Normal's look at cannabis science. We're back once again with our dose of cannabis science and Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Mitch, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back.
All right. So we have talked so many times in the past about the subject of cannabis use and schizophrenia. And one of the things that we have heard many times from our opponents is this idea that there's a certain small subset of people who are have the possibility or the genetic predisposition to becoming schizophrenic. And if they were to use cannabis, there would be a terrible result. It would lead to a cannabis-induced psychosis. And so I'm really glad to have you on the show today to talk about this because of a new report that I saw out of Reuters Health regarding this so-called pot-induced psychosis. And maybe you could explain it to our listeners as to what this new research has found.
This is a great study, and it showed up in Archives of General Psychiatry, which is really the flagship journal of a lot of mental health researchers. And this is a group, a research group, that in the past has published a lot of stuff that made it look like marijuana actually increases the risk of psychosis. But what they've done is essentially follow up folks who had an initial psychotic reaction to cannabis and found that it looks like, based on their evidence, that in fact these people may have been at risk for psychosis beforehand based on the number of psychotic relatives they have, and that it probably wasn't the cannabis. It was probably a set of folks who were going to develop schizophrenia later on anyway, and that in some ways a psychotic reaction to cannabis may be an interesting marker for risk for schizophrenia, but it's not that cannabis is actually causing the disorder. How did they do this is kind of an intriguing question, but the bottom line is that the folks who have a psychotic reaction to marijuana seem to have the same number of schizophrenic or schizotypal or just generally psychotic relatives as folks with the full-blown schizophrenia. And this seems consistent with the idea that, cannabis is not the cause, and just seemed to kind of buttress some of the arguments that we've made in previous work. So Nick Van Dom from my lab, who's been on the stash before, showed that some of these biased assessments about, say, schizotypal personality disorder or some of the psychotic symptoms seem to work against folks who have used cannabis. And now we see that, in fact, these are folks who probably would have developed a psychotic disorder anyway, and that this reaction is really just a hallmark, not a creation of any kind of mental illness.
Right. The smoking pot didn't cause the schizophrenia. The schizophrenic happened to be smoking pot, and that kind of showed up, I guess. Is that a way to say it?
Exactly. And see, for a while there was this subset of diagnostic criteria that were supposed to be marijuana-induced psychosis.
Yeah.
And people would show up at the hospital acting psychotic, and they happened to have used marijuana recently, and people thought, oh, well, there's this high-risk crew, and they're going to have the big psychotic break in reaction to this. But it looks like actually this is more a way to uncover schizophrenia rather than actually contribute to it. And, I mean, I'm going way out on a limb here, but in some sense, if folks have a really extreme, paranoid, outrageous reaction to cannabis the first time, well, of course they shouldn't use it again. It makes complete sense.
And would that possibly be something where if someone found they were with a group of friends and their friends are, you know, let's say regular marijuana users and they don't seem to have bad reactions, and maybe when they try it their first or second time, they feel they have a bad reaction, do you think then that's something that should lead them to want to investigate whether there's any schizotypal disorders in their family history or seek further mental health evaluation?
I think that that's perfectly appropriate and nothing for anybody to, you know, feel like they're being alarmist about. In fact, if you've got, you know, a schizophrenic identical twin or, you know, one of your parents has a psychotic disorder, cannabis is probably not for you. And in fact, I wouldn't, you know, drink too much coffee. I'd take it easy on the Benadryl. Like, you really don't want to have too many psychoactive substances in your system if you're already a little bit prone to a lot of deviant experiences. Friends of mine who I love dearly, who are really creative, interesting, productive people, but who know that they're a little bit on the edge when it comes to having a lot of magical ideas and experiencing some crazy things, and so they stay away from extremes in any kind of habit, including watching their sleep, making sure they exercise regularly, not eating too much sugar and things like that to really take care of themselves. There are other folks who, you know, really have wonderful reactions to cannabis, and we ought to make sure that they get the opportunity to have those.
Have there been any pushbacks from the mainstream medical community against this, these findings? Is anyone, have you heard yet anyone from, say, a drug czar's office or somebody trying to discredit what they're finding here?
Well, this just came out in the November 2008 issue, so there hasn't been a ton of scuttlebutt on it yet. I can tell what they're going to attack, and it's that it's not a randomly assigned sort of thing. These people weren't randomly given cannabis, and so they're going to say, oh, maybe this wasn't actually the situation. But as we're learning more and more about the rates of psychosis and how they vary with rates of cannabis use, it really doesn't fit. So the countries that have heavy rates of cannabis use don't have higher rates of schizophrenia than countries that have very low rates of cannabis use. There are a whole lot of things that kind of take apart this idea that this is causal. Then the notion that there's maybe a subset of folks that are genetically at risk who then use heavily and they're the ones who end up actually being the cannabis-induced psychotic disorders also doesn't seem to fit in light of these data. It really does seem like these are folks who probably would have developed these symptoms anyway.
Yeah, I always make that joke about we didn't see a big rise in schizophrenia after the Summer of Love, even though the clothing and music may have sounded like it. So, but that's always good to know. And the other thing I note about this study, and, you know, I've talked with Paul Armentano numerous times about this, is, again, a study coming out of Denmark, and there would be no way you could probably get this kind of research funded in the United States. Is that still the case?
Because this is longitudinal follow-up and they didn't actually administer the cannabis in this crew, we probably could get data like this gathered. But this is tough work to do. And, in fact, the Scandinavians really have the jump on us in part because they have very complicated registries of everybody who's born there, a very nice socialized medicine system, so you pretty much can keep track of people well. And folks who live there tend to keep living there. For some reason, they really love it, and so they're easier to track than the transient peripatetic Americans who you try to, you know, follow them up for even 2 years in a study, and sometimes you're spending thousands of dollars just ringing up their wrong numbers.
Well, and it seems to me that, you know, they got a pretty large sample size here. There's something like over 600 people that were treated for the cannabis-induced psychosis, or so-called cannabis-induced psychosis, and then versus over 6,400 that had been treated for schizophrenia. I mean, that's a fairly large sample, isn't it?
Oh, this is a landmark study as far as that's concerned. I can only think of one other researcher with data, you know, this big on psychosis in general, and it's Sarnoff Mednick, who started gathering these data when before you were born and when I was a fetus.
Now, is this finally starting to sink in as far as the general medical community, this idea that, I mean, I know that for a long time they had these beliefs that pot was this amotivational thing, and that got debunked, and then somehow that pot was going to cause chromosomal damage, and that got debunked. Are we on the point now where anybody serious about the science here would just listen to any thought of cannabis being causing schizophrenia? Is that being a myth now? Can we say that's debunked?
I would say these data are pretty compellingly disputing that idea. I also find that clinicians I talk to and physicians who are out there in the field agree that they don't want their psychotic patients to use cannabis, and I could not agree more heartily, but they just kind of wink at me at the notion of it being causal. In fact, it's usually so obvious that these folks have some pretty severe genetic anomalies based on some other evidence in their family that the cannabis is the least of the issues. Unfortunately, the folks who still believe this are often the ones who are speaking the loudest, And that's unfortunately the ones who have the money to put advertisements in the newspaper about becoming a burrito taster.
Yeah.
So again, I don't think anyone's going to become psychotic simply because of pot. But if you got schizophrenic in the family, by all means, keep your recreation to the non-substance related activities, and everything will be fine.
Is there any sign that there's any attraction to cannabis by people who have these backgrounds with schizophrenia in their history or background?
As odd as it sounds, and I used to live in a halfway house with 10 psychotics at a time in grad school, so I mean, I know more schizophrenics than most people meet in their lives. I have had psychotic individuals say that it's improved their focus, or that it has helped them in some sense with their symptoms, but that's the kind of talk that's going to get me nailed to a cross on the cover of People magazine. I mean, you really cannot recommend this, because there's some pretty compelling data from the 90s, Thornycroft in particular, suggesting that it tends to predict subsequent relapses really quickly. I think what's going on is people start to notice that their symptoms are returning, turn to cannabis first to try to get control of them, and then realize they have to go to the hospital. Other people assert that it's the cannabis that's actually causing this. Unfortunately, those are the kind of things that we're never going to be able to tease out in humans. Bill McClure at USC is working on a rat model of schizophrenia. I'm eager to see how that all works out, and would love to see him get into the THC research with that.
Wow. What kind of a therapy session does one have with a schizophrenic rat?
I can only imagine.
I'm just trying to imagine what the little survey is and how the rat fills it out. Anyway, Dr. Earlywine, this is all fascinating work on the schizophrenia front, and we'll keep an eye on it until it's finally and thoroughly explained. Thanks again for joining us here for our Cannabis Science segment.
Looking forward to talking to you again.
It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Earlywine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our Daily Audio Stash. Dr. Earlywine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org. Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org.
Yes, Stashers, it's finally happened. I'm finally playing a Bob Marley song. The bad news is that it's not an original song, but a remix of Soul Shakedown Party from his 1969 album Soul Shakedown. The good news is that it's a pretty good remix, and a great groovy tune for a Wednesday. Roots Rock Remixed is touted as the first Bob Marley remix album, combining the classic analog sounds from Marley's Black Ark days with a fresh digital touch. As far as remixes go, they're pretty standard, which is actually a good thing considering they're remixing Bob Marley here. His original songs hardly need remixing in the first place, and the various mixers acknowledge that by being somewhat safe with their mixes. Now, if you want to learn more about Roots Rock Remixed, you can head to their MySpace page or to their website, both of which are linked on our blog at stash.normal.org. And, well, I don't have anything else to say here. I mean, it's Bob Marley, for Pete's sake. I'd link to his MySpace page, but it's Bob Marley. So, without further ado, here is Bob Marley and the Wailers remixed with Soul Shakedown Party.
Yeah. 76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and co-workers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Strop, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Well, we've gotten all the results in from the elections in the United States. Now I'm looking north of the border to Canada, and I find a very, very heartening election result. We're joined by Philippe Lucas, who is now a Victoria City Councillor in Victoria, British Columbia. You may also remember him from previous interviews here on the Daily Audio Stash from his work with the Vancouver Island Compassion Society, which you can learn more about at thevics.com. That's thevics.com. Philippe, welcome back to the Stash.
Well, thank you very much, Russ. It's great to be here.
I think as a newly elected Victoria City Councillor, you are officially the first Canadian government official I've ever interviewed.
Well, I'm honored to have that that designation. And, of course, like so many people around the world, myself and I can honestly say most of Canada was incredibly pleased and relieved at your own election results in the U.S. And we remain, like so many people, cautiously optimistic that this is going to signal a progressive change for U.S. Both domestic and foreign policy under the Obama government.
We are surely hoping so down here, and we're looking at that sweeping mandate of change down here with our recent initiatives, too, with the medical marijuana in Michigan and decriminalization in Massachusetts passing with nearly 2-to-1 support. So we are hoping that wave of change will take place down here. And, you know, I don't know a whole lot about municipal Victoria politics, but just reading some of the news articles I read, it kind of looked like there was kind of a sweeping mandate there in Victoria as well. Can you give our listeners kind of a thumbnail sketch of what the politics were there in Victoria and your election to the council and what that's going to mean for the city?
Absolutely. Every 3 years in Victoria and in all of British Columbia, we hold municipal elections. Victoria is the capital of British Columbia, which is, of course, our west coast province here in Canada. And in this municipal election, we had 35 candidates running for 8 spots on city council and 8 mayoral candidates running, of course, for the single spot as mayor. And I was running under the Green Party ticket with a co-candidate, Sonia Chandler, who was an incumbent. She's a nurse who works at our downtown youth clinic with youth at risk. And we both got in, and along with a number of other progressive candidates that we were working with. And so we, for the first time in a number of years here in the city, feel that we have a very good progressive majority on council. And we're really talking about bringing a different approach to some of our most pressing issues here in Victoria. And the two that I hope to address and that clearly the public would like to see addressed as a priority are homelessness. We've got an incredibly high level of visible homelessness here in the city of Victoria, and harm reduction. We've currently lost our only fixed site needle exchange here in the city of Victoria, putting us into a serious public health crisis as far as our injection drug user population. And so those are the two areas where I'm going to put a tremendous amount of energy initially. And another issue that that is very close to my heart is food security, and so we'll be working on that as well.
That's great to hear that along with yourself, you've got some other people working alongside of you. You'll be able to put together a majority to get some of these things tackled. Now, with regard to the medical marijuana that's going on there in Canada, I know that you work with the Vancouver Island Compassion Society, and that one of the issues that we have up there with medical marijuana in Canada has to do with the supply coming through Health Canada and only being produced up in that abandoned mine in Flin Flon, Manitoba. I just love to say Flin Flon, Manitoba. So apparently you've got a court decision that you're looking forward to here, and tell us what the latest is on that constitutional challenge.
We do. It's been an exciting fall. I had a baby about 8 weeks ago, and of course we had the municipal election results over the weekend, and within the next 3 or 4 weeks we expect a court decision on a constitutional challenge, a charter challenge that we've raised against the government about 4 years ago, which stems from a federal raid on our research and production facility, which was called the Vancouver Island Therapeutic Cannabis Research Institute. That raid took place in 2004, and over the last 4 years, we've been through the BC Supreme Court, essentially suing the government in regards to that raid, and we are very optimistic about the outcomes of that case. We had a lot of help from down south, from the U.S. in both assistance in funding this case, as well as bringing some experts up. We had Dr. Bob Melamede of the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, come and testify on our behalf. And we expect within the next 3 or 4 weeks a decision on that case. And if we're victorious, it could have the potential to seriously open up access to medical marijuana here in Canada. Despite having a federal program in Canada, we've only protected right now about 2,000 Canadians through Health Canada's federal medical marijuana scheme, even though Health Canada estimates there's currently about 1 million Canadians who claim to be using marijuana for medical purposes. So we see that overwhelmingly people who use medical marijuana in Canada aren't protected from arrest and prosecution, and our court cases will hopefully change that in the next few weeks.
Wow, you get a new baby, you win election to the city council, and hopefully you get this court decision to go in your favor. Perhaps good things will come in threes for you, Philippe. That sounds
great.
We're
going for the trifecta.
Absolutely.
No doubt. It's been already the most remarkable year in recent memory for myself, and I'm incredibly. It just seems like a lot of the projects, but not just myself, but a lot of us here in Canada have been working on over the last few years are coming to fruition in 2008, and so we do hope that before the end of the year we'll get a positive decision and be able to move forward optimistically in 2009, so we can join our southern neighbors and. With a real sense of change and optimism.
You betcha. Now, the other thing I was thinking about, too, is when you were running for this seat, you know, and Victoria's a fairly large city, and it sounded like there was a lot of people running. How much did your personal involvement with these issues of harm reduction and medical marijuana, did that cost you any political... I mean, obviously it must not have, but did anyone try to make hay out of that, trying to use your drug reform credentials against you?
Interestingly, not overtly. I've no doubt that there, for some people, it was a concern that there was some efforts to paint me as a more radical candidate. But I do a lot of work outside of drug policy reform here for our community on homelessness, harm reduction, and food security issues. And I think that the electorate wasn't clouded by the fact that I'm involved in drug policy research and reform. Otherwise, I also think that we're at a point of maturity in this community anyway, where people understand that my support and my work towards medical marijuana is really part and parcel of increasing our and improving our social justice approach to some of these issues. In other words, people don't see me so much as a distributor of medical marijuana, but I think as someone who's spent time and energy caring for critically and chronically ill in this community. I was previously a school teacher in the community as well, and so I think that a community that's trusted me both with their kids as well as their sick and suffering citizens, I actually feel that helped them trust me more in terms of handing over some of the responsibilities of the city.
Wow.
So it really didn't become an election issue, which really, to me, shows the how much our community has evolved in regards to these issues.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say is, wow, I mean, I can't think of a whole lot of places, maybe, you know, Berkeley, California, Portland, Oregon, maybe a few places in the United States where a drug reformer such as yourself, someone so involved, wouldn't get that used so much against them. And it's so great to see, you know, your involvement in all these other issues, too. That's something I always try to tell reformers is to you know, open up your horizons a little bit and broaden a little bit and get involved with other issues and other communities, so that those communities can see they have nothing to fear from us. So thank you so much for doing that, Philippe.
Well, I think we all gain by doing that. I think that ultimately the oppression of cannabis users, whether recreational or medical, and other drug users, is the same as the oppression of our poor and dispossessed. It's the same kind of oppression that we see across a number of social justice issues. And so we can bring our experience as drug policy reformers to help others deal with their issues as well. And so whether it be women or minority issues, whether it be the homelessness that I've been working with and the poverty issues that we're working on, I actually draw on my experience as a drug policy reform advocate and activist and bring some of that experience to these other movements. And I think that they really benefit from that as well.
I think
the other interesting invitation that I got recently, which I think shows a growing level of maturity in Canada in general around these issues, is I was invited to be guest editor of a journal called Visions, which is the Mental Health and Addictions Journal of British Columbia.
Hmm.
It's actually supported by the Canadian Mental Health Association. And in February, they're doing a whole issue on cannabis, and they've invited me to be guest editor. And I was extremely pleased and honored by that invitation and the fact that they would consider someone who's involved in the more controversial aspects around cannabis rather than, say, just going for a pure academic researcher, I think was a really bold choice.
Yeah, I'll be looking forward to that. And we'll get back in touch with you as that comes out. Well, maybe we can get some excerpts or something. That would be great to see. Philippe Lucas is a city councillor elect in Victoria, British Columbia, and works along with the Vancouver Island Compassion Society. Learn more about them at thevix.com. We'll have information up at our blog, stash.normal.org. And congratulations on becoming a new father as well.
Well, thank you very much, Russ. I really appreciate it. And best of luck for you guys in the transition of your federal government. We're watching with bated breath down here to see what this means in real terms.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.normal.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another one of our cannabis quotes, this one a surprising one from the outgoing lame duck president, George W. Bush, who actually once said, quote, "Healthcare decisions ought to be between doctors and patients, not by officials in Washington, D.C. End quote. Really? So, how do you explain all those raids in medical marijuana states again? Between the officials from Washington, D.C. and the healthcare decisions that are between the doctors and patients in California and the other states? Oh, well, let's let bygones be bygones. As in, George W. Bush, bye. Time for you to be gone. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us here for the podcast. We'll be back tomorrow with more news and interviews you can use for the cannabis community. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.